May 23rd, 1996. The tension was high in the rural town of Jordan, Montana. It had been 2 months since 100 FBI agents first surrounded the Clark family ranch. They were in a standoff against the Montana Freemen, an anti-government, white nationalist paramilitary group.
Inside the Freeman's Ranch, better known as Justice Township, were roughly 10 heavily armed men. Trapped with them were their families, over a dozen women and children. Any sudden move on the FBI's part could lead to the death of innocents.
For the past week, Freeman leader Rodney Skirtle had agreed to sporadic talks with FBI negotiators, but today had been silent.
As usual, snipers watched through their scopes for any changes inside the compound.
Suddenly, a flash of red and white peeked over a rooftop. The Freemen were raising an upside-down American flag, a universal signal of distress.
The FBI eyed it suspiciously. They knew it meant one thing. The Freemen were done negotiating.
Either the radicals were going to walk out of their own free will,
or blood was going to be spilled.
This is Hostage, a Parcast original. Every week, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in kidnapping situations and what the human brain does when held captive.
I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
You can listen to all of Parcast's shows on Spotify or anywhere you listen to podcasts. New episodes of Hostage come out every Thursday.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
Today, we're doing a special one-part episode about the Montana Freemen, an anti-government militant group who staged one of the longest armed standoffs against the FBI in U.S. history in 1996.
We'll delve into the rise of the Freemen and how they used paper terrorism to control various sections of Montana in the early 1990s. Then we'll explore how undercover FBI agents helped bring down the extremist group without shedding a single drop of blood.
In the late 1980s and early 1990s, the United States saw a rise in far-right paramilitary groups, especially out west. What set them apart from past hate groups was that they weren't trying to reform the government. In fact, many were very much anti-government.
This trend became known as the Christian Patriot Movement. Much of what these groups preached was typical racist and anti-Semitic rhetoric. Whites were superior, everything else was subhuman.
None of these views were original, but what differentiated the Christian Patriot Movement from, say, the KKK, was that they married their anti-Semitism with a general mistrust of the U.S. government. They preached a unique conspiracy which alleges that Jewish bankers control various Western governments, and in their view, the United States was actually being run by a covert organization called the Zionist Occupation Government.
Like any polarizing group, the Christian Patriots needed recruits, and they found these in the disenfranchised and disillusioned farmers across America's rural West.
In the late 1970s, President Jimmy Carter encouraged agriculture expansion, leading many ranchers and farmers to take out huge loans to buy equipment. Unfortunately, crop prices stagnated and a grain embargo against the USSR left many farmers with unsold product. These angry white farmers now owed thousands of dollars in loan payments to the IRS or the banks.
In the farmers' eyes, they'd been betrayed, making them suspicious of the U.S. government overall. These sorts of disgruntled characters made perfect recruits, giving rise to more and more Christian patriot groups. One of these was the Montana Freemen.
The Montana Freemen were founded in the early 1990s by a man named Leroy Schweitzer. Born in 1937, during the last years of the Great Depression, Schweitzer spent the bulk of the 1970s and 80s as a crop duster in Montana and Idaho. when he wasn't spraying fields with pesticides, he was tuning in to the anti-government and anti-tax rhetoric being spewed throughout the region.
Exactly when Schweitzer aligned himself with these beliefs is unclear, but by 1973, Schweitzer had decided he didn't need to pay his taxes. And by the early 1990s, he had accumulated $400,000 in back taxes.
But he couldn't hide forever. In January 1993, the IRS caught up with the 55-year-old Schweitzer, seizing his house, crop duster, and various properties.
Schweitzer was indignant. All he wanted to do was live independently of the U.S. government, but instead, he felt like their slave. Furious, he decided it was time to take up arms and put an end to the tyranny of the United States government. But for that, he would need help.
In less than a year, Schweitzer formed the nucleus for the Montana Freeman by adding three other anti-establishment leaders, Rodney Skirtle, Daniel Peterson, and Dale Jacoby.
Rodney Skirtle was a Marine veteran who worked for many years in the Wyoming oil fields. By the 1980s, he had identified himself as an anti-government radical and moved to Roundup, Montana, where he became acquainted with Schweitzer.
In 1993, the IRS foreclosed on Skirtle's cabin in Roundup. But unlike Schweitzer, Skirtle refused to vacate. He took up arms and threatened anyone who tried to come on his property and evict him. His Roundup cabin ultimately served as the Freeman's first headquarters.
The two other Freeman leaders, Daniel Peterson and Dale Jacoby, were simply angry racists who also hated the government. And while all four were technically equal leaders, it was clearly Schweitzer who led the charge. He reigned over the Freeman, exhibiting many of the classic traits found in a cult leader.
According to former FBI counterintelligence agent Joe Navarro, cult leaders have a grandiose idea of who they are and what they can achieve, and an exaggerated sense of power and entitlement that allows them to bend the rules and break laws. And on top of that, they have a tendency to isolate themselves from the rest of society.
Schweitzer certainly had this brazen vision for his Freeman. In fact, his ultimate goal was to create a separate nation within the state of Montana. Of course, this would ultimately require a violent overthrow of the government, which none of the Freemen had a problem with. According to their self-righteous rhetoric, murdering enemies was entirely justified.
In the skewed perspective of the Freemen, a revolution would be simple. They and their recruits would divide into 12 battle squads, like the tribes of Israel in the Old Testament, an ironic choice for these otherwise anti-Semitic men.
These squads would then overthrow the local government and hang all government officials for being part of the alleged Zionist occupation. Next, they would murder anyone who wasn't white before establishing total Freeman rule.
In this new nation, the Freemen hoped to create three levels of a theocracy-based government: national, state, and county. But unlike the U.S. government, local townships would be allowed the final say. In their eyes, this would be the antithesis to national democracy, where Big Brother government always had the last word.
Of course, where this eventual revolution would take place was still up for debate. All the leaders knew was that it would be somewhere in Montana.
The Freeman leader felt confident in their grand vision, but first, they needed men, which they slowly gathered from the surrounding regions of Muscle Shell and Garfield counties.
Schweitzer and the Freeman also began forming connections with like-minded militias from out of state. But these groups were not particularly interested in overthrowing the government in Montana. And arguably, many of the Freeman's own members were not too interested in a far-off revolution either. They were more interested in the Freeman's notorious money-making schemes.
Throughout 1994 and 1995, the Montana Freeman financed themselves using various forms of paper terrorism. They utilized legal loopholes and early computer technology to print bogus checks and commit wire fraud.
The Freeman would often write fake checks for more than the cost of an item purchased. Then they would ask for the balance to be given to them in cash. For example, if something cost $5,000, a freeman would write a check for $10,000 and ask for the other $5,000 in cash. By the time the false check bounced, the freeman member was long gone with $5,000 cash in their pocket.
While this scam was successful, the group didn't truly garner attention until early 1995, thanks to their increasing use of false liens. In the most basic definition, a lien is when someone has the right to claim someone else's property, such as a car, a house, or land, because the original owner supposedly owes them a large amount of money. When a lien is filed on a piece of property, it makes it difficult or even impossible for the original owner to sell the property or borrow against it. Legal fees add to the excruciating process of removing a lien from one's property, often prolonging the entire ordeal.
In early 1995, the freemen were issuing false liens left and right, and they especially loved to do this as a way of terrorizing local government officials. If the group ran up against a nosy public agent, like a district attorney or sheriff, they would simply file a lien against a piece of that person's property.
By now, the people of Musselshell County and Garfield County, Montana, had had enough. It was time for the federal government to step in, and the FBI was already on the case. It's unclear exactly when the FBI began investigating the Freeman's paper terrorism, but by spring of 1995, they had sealed indictments against Schweitzer and the others for fraud.
The problem they were facing, however, was making the actual arrest. It wasn't as easy as swooping in with handcuffs. For all they knew, these men could be extremely violence-prone, or they could be all talk. Either way, the last thing the FBI wanted was a repeat of Ruby Ridge or Waco.
For years, Americans had complained that federal law enforcement was overzealous when it came to using force. And in August 1992, a fiasco in Ruby Ridge, Idaho, brought this conversation to the forefront.
For 11 days, survivalist and fugitive Randy Weaver and his family were holed up in their house in the Idaho mountains. When he finally gave himself up, his wife Vicky and 14-year-old son Sammy were dead.
6 months later, the FBI engaged in another standoff, this time against a group known as the Branch Davidians in Waco, Texas. Frustrated by the lack of progress during the 51-day ordeal, Attorney General Janet Reno gave the order to mount an assault.
On April 19, 1993, the FBI threw 400 canisters of tear gas inside the compound. In response, the Branch Davidians fired at the FBI. In the ensuing chaos, a fire broke out, and within an hour, the entire compound was nothing but ash. Nearly 80 men, women, and children perished.
Because of Ruby Ridge and Waco, public opinion on federal law enforcement was still low in the spring of 1995. And when it came to bringing down the Freeman, the FBI was leery. Were they actually as dangerous as they claimed to be? Or were they most like Christian patriot groups, all bark and no bite?
The FBI hemmed and hawed about the best way to hand out the Freeman indictments. But another tragic event would soon force them to accelerate their arrests.
On April 19, 1995, at around 9 a.m., a Ryder rental truck exploded at the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, killing over 160 people and injuring more than 650 others. It was the largest instance of domestic terrorism in United States history, and it was carried out by two anti-government militants, Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols.
The Oklahoma City bombing was a wake-up call for the FBI. It was time to start taking these anti-government groups seriously. They weren't just fringe outsiders complaining loudly. They were capable of mass violence. And in Montana, that meant focusing their attention on one particular group, the Freeman. Coming up, the FBI makes its first move.
Now back to the story.
In the early 1990s, a disgruntled crop duster named Leroy Schweitzer and a few of his anti-government comrades created the Montana Freeman. Their dream was to eventually stage a local government takeover and establish their own independent nation within the state of Montana. In the meantime, the group attracted a trickle of new members through their deft use of fraud to make money.
By early 1995, the FBI had sealed indictments against various members of the group, but they were reticent to pull the trigger. They were worried about inciting violence and subsequently public ire.
But all this changed following the Oklahoma City bombing on April 19, 1995. A wave of panic overcame the FBI and America. Who was going to be next?
For the FBI in Montana, this meant setting their sights on 57-year-old Leroy Schweitzer and his Freeman cronies.
The FBI still had no idea as to how dangerous the Freemen were. They just knew that the four leaders, including Schweitzer and Rodney Skirtle, were heavily armed and holed up in Skirtle's cabin in Roundup, Montana. They needed information from the inside, and they already had the perfect agent in mind, Dale Jakes.
44-year-old Dale Jakes already had experience as a civilian undercover agent, working for organizations like the FBI, ATF, and DEA throughout the 1980s. But in 1988, Dale decided it was time to live a simpler life, and he and his wife Connie moved to Montana, eventually ending up in Petroleum County, about an hour north of Roundup.
Dale bounced from job to job, and by early 1995, he was working as a bartender. Several of his regulars were Montana Freeman members, and Dale witnessed their anti-government talk firsthand. He hated their bastardized interpretation of the Bible and their latent disdain for paying taxes, but he carefully kept these thoughts to himself. It was no secret that the Freemen were capable of financial terrorism, and the last thing Dale wanted was to get in their way.
That is, until the FBI got a hold of him. They knew that with Dale's previous work experience and his bartending position, he would make the perfect decoy. In spring of 1995, they approached Dale about infiltrating the Freemen and feeding intel back to the FBI.
At first, Dale was hesitant. It had been about 7 years since his last undercover job, and he knew the strain it could be on his family. But between the Freemen's reputation and the recent Oklahoma City bombing, Dale felt he needed to go deep one last time.
Dale knew exactly who he would target, one of his patrons, a Freeman named Lyle Chamberlain. He and Lyle were on such good terms that Lyle had previously asked Dale point blank if he wanted to join the Freeman. Dale had always turned him down, but by April of 1995, when Dale's FBI assignment was made official, he called Lyle and said he was ready to become a Freeman.
A few days later, Dale was brought into Skirtle's cabin and presented before the four Freeman leaders for their customary inquisition. For hours, Schweitzer, Skirtle, and their comrades interrogated Dale. They wanted to make sure he shared the same perspective on race, religion, and government. Dale answered flawlessly. Then came the last question. Why did he want to become a Freeman?
Dale had rehearsed his answer many times, and he told them exactly what they were hoping to hear. The United States was under attack by foreigners, and the federal government had financially ruined his family. Joining the Montana Freemen was a noble cause to finally right the injustices faced by everyday white Americans.
The Freemen smiled back at Dale. He was officially one of them. And according to Dale in his book, False Prophets, what really seemed to impress the leaders was his previous involvement with hate groups and how along the way he picked up an unusual knowledge of explosives. Obviously, he had not told them that this was all in service of groups like the FBI.
In the weeks that followed, Dale was swiftly brought into the Freeman's fold. He accumulated intelligence on how their bank fraud schemes worked, as well as the layout of Skirtle's cabin in Roundup. All of this information went back to the FBI.
As Dale delved deeper into the group's ins and outs, he was amazed at how unorganized the Freeman's accounts were. And so, with the FBI's permission, he suggested they bring in a bookkeeper to organize the offices, and he knew the perfect candidate, his 37-year-old wife, Connie.
Connie wasn't a stranger to undercover work. She herself had worked as a civilian operative before, and she was extremely familiar with Dale's assignments. And when her husband approached her about joining the Freeman job, she was willing to help, hoping it might expedite the mission.
Over the next few weeks, the Jake's undercover work proved fruitful. The FBI was getting more information on the Freeman than they had ever imagined. It felt like only a matter of time before arrests would be made, but things weren't that easy.
Tension among the leaders was starting to form, much of this having to do with tense relations with other militias and stagnant recruitment numbers.
The Freeman's mission was always to separate from the United States and create a separate nation within the state of Montana. As radicals, they felt that their plan was obviously the best, and they expected other like-minded militias to hop on board. But not everyone was interested. Oklahoma militias, for example, had no intention of relocating to Montana.
This failure to gain support resulted in tension among the Montana Freeman leaders. By the end of spring 1995, the arguments at Freeman meetings were becoming increasingly heated. Meanwhile, members of the group were passively retaliating against the local government. Wanted posters for public officials popped up across Musselshell and Garfield counties.
The Jakes urged the FBI to strike before the group did anything brash, but the FBI still refused. It was imperative that they avoid a violent fiasco like Ruby Ridge or Waco. But that didn't mean they were just sitting on their hands. Unbeknownst to Dale and Connie Jakes, the FBI had already hired another investigator to infiltrate the group.
In the summer of 1995, Montana Freeman founder Leroy Schweitzer began a phone correspondence with a sympathizer named Mike Manson. Mike was assisting the Freeman with their bank fraud schemes, or at least he appeared to be. Mike was actually a 38-year-old FBI agent named Tim Healy.
In no time at all, Healy was able to convince the leaders that he was just as disgruntled with the government. He had earned their total trust.
Between Healy and the Jakes, the FBI felt they were closing in on the Freeman. They just had to decide when and how to slap on the handcuffs. But in September of 1995, the situation became unexpectedly complicated.
Rodney Skirtle was butting heads with the other leaders over the fact that recruitment was so low and the revolution hadn't started. By September 1995, Schweitzer and the others were so annoyed with Skirtle that they decided to move their base of operations out of Skirtle's home in Roundup. The group wasn't splitting in two. They were simply sending a message to Skirtle to pipe down.
That month, roughly two dozen Freeman members and their families moved to a 940-acre ranch near Jordan, Montana. The landowners, a family called the Clarks, were Freemen as well and had offered up their land as the new headquarters. Isolated by rolling hills and patches of forest, the ranch was the perfect place to begin their sovereign state. With this in mind, they renamed the Clark Ranch Justice Township.
Dale Jakes continued to provide intel on the new Justice Township for the FBI, just as he had for Skirtle's cabin and Roundup, but he had a medical condition that laid him up for the winter of 1995. In light of this, FBI agent Tim Healy swooped in to take Dale and Connie's place.
Sometime in the winter of 1995, Freeman founder Leroy Schweitzer invited Healy to meet him face to face. In Healy, Schweitzer saw the perfect recruit.
Healy was able to win Schweitzer over by appealing to his inflated ego. According to former FBI Special Agent Joe Navarro, cult leaders seem to be highly dependent on tribute and adoration and will often fish for compliments.
As an FBI agent, Healy identified Schweitzer's appetite for admiration. He used it to his advantage, creating a false aura of admiration that further endeared himself to Schweitzer. And within weeks of his arrival at Justice Township, Healy had been sworn in as an official Montana Freeman member. Now that Healy was living inside Justice Township, the FBI knew it was high time to begin making arrests. And the perfect opportunity came in March of 1996.
The Freeman wanted to install security cameras around the perimeter of Justice Township. The FBI's plan was to have undercover agents pose as the install crew. Healy was then to isolate Schweitzer on the ranch grounds, and when he gave the signal, the undercover agents would bust out handcuffs.
On March 25th, 1996, the plan kicked into action. Agent Healy drove with Schweitzer and another Freeman leader, Daniel Peterson, to a remote location on the Justice Township compound. The premise of this trip was to inspect the ongoing installation of security cameras.
Healy knew he had to be smooth. Both Schweitzer and Peterson were toting guns. After several tense minutes at the location, Healy discreetly gave the signal.
The installation crew pounced on Schweitzer and Peterson, pinning them to the ground. They quickly slapped on handcuffs and hightailed it out of the compound.
Healy breathed a sigh of relief. His mission was done.
But the FBI's job was far from over. As the installation truck left, other agents swarmed into the compound, ready to arrest Rodney Skirtle and the roughly 10 other armed militiamen. But they were met with rifles in their faces.
The agents immediately backed down. They desperately wanted to avoid bloodshed. But even they could see that the Montana Freemen weren't going to go down without a fight.
Coming up, Skirtle and his cronies engage in one of the longest standoffs in U.S. history.
Now, back to the story.
On March 25th, 1996, the FBI finally took down 58-year-old Montana Freeman founder Leroy Schweitzer and his fellow leader, Daniel Peterson. The head of the snake was cut off. But unfortunately, it was only the beginning of a grueling standoff between the FBI and the remaining members of Justice Township.
After arresting Schweitzer and Peterson, the FBI stormed Justice, ready to serve warrants against the other dozen or so Freemen. They were not met by hands in the air, but with AR-15 rifles. The remaining Freemen made it clear that if the feds wanted more arrests, they would have to fight for them.
This went against the staunch no-violence policy the FBI had adopted for this case. The agents swiftly backed off.
But their cover had been blown. The Montana Freemen knew that for the first time, the FBI were on to them.
Outside the perimeter, FBI agents kept their eyes trained on the compound. They knew it housed not only the Freemen, but also their wives and children.
The FBI was not about to fire on innocents. It was just a matter of whether the Freemen would give up or open fire first.
The standoff had begun.
From the get-go, the FBI announced that it wasn't going to use tactical teams as leads as it had in the past. These sorts of teams were responsible for the bloodshed at Ruby Ridge and Waco, having organized raids that ended catastrophically.
Instead, FBI Director Louis Free announced that FBI negotiators, including profilers, would be the ones making the decisions on the Justice Township standoff.
FBI profilers typically act like consultants in hostage situations. Their job is to analyze crime scenes, provide criminal backgrounds, seek out various negotiation techniques, and assess potential threats. Through their expert researching skills, they provide the other agents in charge with the necessary information so as to avoid unexpected scenarios.
Given the self-sufficiency of Justice Township, this was probably going to take some time. The compound was sure to be stockpiled with supplies, which meant the standoff could last for weeks, even months. Knowing this, the FBI, ATF, and local law enforcement settled in for the long haul. They set up headquarters in the nearby town of Jordan, and they waited. The hope was that Rodney Skirtle and his Freeman comrades would eventually agree to a conversation with negotiators.
But not all the Freemen were inside Justice Township. Those on the outside coalesced to form a plan, setting up a base at Cat Creek Ranch, the home of Freeman member Lyle Chamberlain. From here, the Freemen sent out an SOS to other out-of-state anti-government militias.
Ironically, many of these out-of-state leaders despised the Montana Freemen and their leaders, believing they were nothing more than a bunch of fraud-committing crooks. Nonetheless, several groups traveled to Cat Creek to help. For them, it was about the principle of standing up to the feds.
With the FBI keeping an eye on Justice Township, and the Freemen and their sympathizers keeping an eye on the FBI from Cat Creek, the situation had developed into something of a target with Justice Township as its bullseye. Everyone was waiting for someone else to make the first move.
The FBI's main concern was still the safety of the wives and children inside the justice compound. They repeated their offer to speak with Skirtle, but to no avail.
By early April, 3 weeks into the tense standoff, the temperature was changing among the Freemen and their out-of-state helpers at Cat Creek. Regardless of group affiliations, the men were beginning to form into two groups, the radicals and the moderates.
The radicals believed that now was the time to stage a fight against the feds. They saw it as a call to action for the overarching Christian Patriot movement, with the potential to ignite a successful revolution against the U.S. government.
The moderates, on the other hand, were more concerned about appearances. They didn't want the rest of America to see them as just another white supremacist group or another Waco-like cult. They argued that in order for their cause to be taken seriously, it was important that they didn't behave like backwoods crazies.
Ultimately, the radicals ignored the moderates and began to form a plan. They wanted to rush into the compound to provide reinforcements to Skirtle and his clan. With this in mind, the radicals began outfitting their trucks with blades and battering rams, like something out of Mad Max. They purposely planned their attack for April 19th, the anniversary of both Waco and the Oklahoma City bombing.
They didn't care about aligning themselves with these tragedies. In fact, they liked the idea. Maybe then the U.S. government would take them seriously.
In the meantime, civilian undercover operative Dale Jakes had recovered from his health condition that laid him up for most of the past winter. He was back at work, infiltrating the Freeman group on the outside of Justice Township. He quickly saw the divide between the radicals and the moderates, and he was worried that if the radicals moved forward with their attack, all hell would break loose, potentially wounding the innocent people inside Justice Township.
According to Dale, when he told his FBI handlers about the upcoming April 19th attack, they shrugged him off. They didn't have any warrants against the men at Cat Creek, and so, astonishingly, they simply ignored the warning.
It's possible the real reason the FBI chose to brush Dale off was because they still refused to involve themselves in a gunfight. In order to make a move, they would have to wait until the Cat Creek radicals tried to break into Justice Township, and any ensuing gunfire could put the women and children at risk. Whatever the reason, Dale felt he needed to do something personally to prevent the violence.
On April 18th, the day before the radicals' planned attack, Dale went to Cat Creek. There he discovered a new rumor. The radicals believed that the FBI were on to them and would be the first ones to attack the next day. They believed this preemptive attack was going to take place at Cat Creek and not Justice Township.
Dale immediately saw the confusion as his chance to defuse the situation. He posited that if the FBI were to attack, it would probably be at night. Therefore, the smart play would be to take all of the small militia groups around central Montana and have them coalesce around Cat Creek instead of Justice in preparation for the attack.
In reality, Dale hoped this plan would move the militias away from Justice Township and distract them long enough to let April 19th pass without violence.
The militia leaders bought into Dale's plan, and they immediately made the call to move forces away from Justice to Cat Creek. Then they waited for nightfall.
But nothing happened. April 19th, 1996 came and went. Not a bullet was fired, not a barricade was broken, and not a single FBI agent descended on Cat Creek. According to Dale Jakes, he he had single-handedly managed to stop a gunfight.
Not long after April 19th, the FBI began contacting various out-of-state radical militias. The goal was to convince them that the FBI was intending to wait out the Freemen until they surrendered. Hopefully, this would incite the out-of-state militias to give up and head home.
It worked. In the following weeks, the outside militias gradually trickled out of Montana, leaving the Freemen at Cat Creek alone. But things weren't as simple as the FBI hoped.
Dale Jake soon discovered that this exodus was part of a secret plan among the militias. Should the FBI fire upon Justice Township, the other groups would swoop in with coordinated attacks all across the United States. The details remain unclear to this day, but according to Dale, the attacks would include assassinations of government officials.
The FBI initially downplayed the news. They were still hopeful that these militias were all talk. However, a few days later, they sent out word to other FBI branches, warning them to be on the lookout for potential attacks.
In the meantime, the agents in Montana continued to dig in their heels. These rumors were just further reason why they could not be the first to fire.
By mid-May, the standoff was reaching the two-month mark, and the FBI's offers of negotiation had gone completely ignored. In total, they had offered 42 different representatives, including politicians, family members, and even other right-wing activists, but to no avail, the Freemen refused to talk.
Finally, on May 16th, Rodney Skirtle caved. He agreed to talk, along with fellow Freeman leader Dale Jacoby, not to be confused with undercover agent Dale Jakes.
For a week, Skirtle and Jacoby spoke with Colorado State Senator Charles Duke and two FBI negotiators. These meetings were kept private, but Skirtle reportedly threw tantrums, and no evident progress was made.
A week later, on May 23rd, Justice Township raised an upside-down American flag, the universal symbol of distress. The FBI hoped this meant that they would be leaving, but instead, the day marked the end of negotiations.
Evidently, the compound was signaling to its sympathizers that they needed reinforcement soon. But over a week would go by until the group made another gesture.
From late May to early June, the FBI seemed to be changing their mind. Negotiations with Skirtle had failed miserably, and the standoff had exceeded 2 months. They knew it was time to do something.
On June 3rd, they cut the power inside Justice Township. That same day, the Freemen acquiesced to speak with the sister of one of their members.
Both tactics seemed to have a positive result. A few days later, one family walked out of Justice. With the promise of no federal charges against them, they decided their ideals were no longer worth risking the lives of their children.
Over the following days, more and more women and children were released from Justice Township. And on June 12th, a 16-year-old girl was the last child to leave the compound. With only armed men left inside, the FBI planned a bold escalation of plans.
The next morning, June 13th, FBI vans circled the perimeter of the property. To the Freemen inside, it appeared that a potential assault was on the horizon.
The moment of truth had come. Were they going to fight back? Or were they exactly what the FBI had hoped they were all along? Just a bunch of loud talking lunatics.
At this point, the Freemen's supplies were nearly depleted. Even if they could succeed in the first wave of an attack, they could hardly be expected to repel another, or another after that.
On top of all that, Freeman leader Rodney Skirtle had run out of cigarettes. He was jonesing hard for his nicotine fix.
To the relief of everyone, the Freemen put down their arms. One by one, they surrendered to the FBI. The 81-day standoff at Justice Township was over. Not a single shot was fired. Not a drop of blood was spilled.
When the sun finally set on June 13, 1996, a total of 24 Montana Freemen had been arrested. They were charged for a litany of crimes, including bank fraud, armed robbery, conspiracy, and illegal possession of firearms.
In 1998, Freeman founder Leroy Schweitzer was sentenced to 22 years in prison. During the trial, he caused so much disruption that he was eventually gagged for the constant outbursts. He died of natural causes at his Supermax prison in Pueblo, Colorado in 2011.
Daniel Peterson, the man arrested with Schweitzer, was originally sentenced to 15 years after being found guilty on 19 of the 20 charges against him. However, in the 2000s, Peterson devised a scheme while in prison in which he filed bogus liens against the judge who sentenced him years earlier. When prosecutors caught wind of this, they added an extra 7.5 years to his sentence.
Meanwhile, Rodney Skirtle, the leader who had led the standoff between Justice Township and the FBI, was sentenced to 15 years in prison. His crony, the fourth Freeman leader, Dale Jacoby, was given 13 years.
Their plot to subvert the U.S. government had landed each of them in federal prison.
Thanks again for tuning in to Hostage. We'll be back next Thursday with a new episode. Among the many resources we used, we found False Prophets by Dale and Connie Jakes to be especially helpful in our research.
You can find more episodes of Hostage, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Spotify or anywhere else you listen to podcasts.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted.
Hostage was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studio original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Mike Ramos, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Isabella Way. This episode of Hostage was written by Joe Guerra, with writing assistance by Kate Gallagher, and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.